Humans are allergic to change. They love to say, "We've always done it this way." I try to fight that. That's why I have a clock on my wall that runs counterclockwise. Hey everyone, welcome to episode 16 of Making Comics Gutter Talk. My name is Adam Greenfield. I am your host. Episode 16. Well, I don't know. I guess that makes the podcast old enough to drive itself, but I refuse to let that happen because we all know how 16-year-olds drive. Probably like most of the people here in California. All right, anyway. That quote you just heard was from Rear Admiral Grace Hopper. She was a 20th century mathematician and computer scientist. And follow me here. This is how awesome she was. She joined the Navy right in the middle of World War II. It was the early 40s. Just joined the Navy. She was in a graduate program for mathematics. So she joined the Navy in the early 40s, became one of the first programmers of the Harvard Mark I, which is basically the one of the first, I guess you can say, proto-computer. So that was pretty cool. She retired from the Navy in the mid-60s. A little bit later, she unretired. And then she retired again in 1986. And in 1986, she was 80 years old. That's right. She retired from the Navy at 80 years old. What are you doing with your life? So I have to say that she is quite an inspiration and heck of an achievement, heck of a life that she led. So it's really cool. If you don't know much about Rear Admiral Grace Hopper, definitely check some stuff out. The quote I mentioned earlier, as well as others, are just fantastic. So anyway, before we jump into this episode, today, Friday, April 18th, is the first day of Comic-Con. I meant WonderCon, not Comic-Con. Sorry. Here in Anaheim, California. Well, I wouldn't say here. I'm not in Anaheim, but I'm close enough to say here. It's going to be a good one. It's going to be a good one. We have a panel up there tomorrow, Saturday the 19th, at 4 p.m. in room 210A. It's called Making Comics with the World. On the panel is Shelley Cuvion and Rachel Beck from Storyforge Productions. We have Jason Brubaker, the creator of Cythra and Remind, as well as the MakingComics.com crew. Patrick Urich, the CEO. We got Kevin Cullen, the, the content editor. We have Devin Larson, the editor-in-chief. And myself, the voice that is playing in your earbuds or speakers or face or I don't know, whatever, however you're hearing me. We'll be there. So if you are there, check it out. If you can't make it, I don't know what your lame excuse is, but I'll let it slide this time. And I'll even do one more for you. We're gonna try to turn this into some audio, the panel. So hopefully we can get that out into a sort of a special episode for you guys. So can't make any promises, but I'm really hoping. So that is the plan. Keep an ear out for that. All right, this episode, I gotta say, this is a really cool one. We joined Ted Adams today. He's the CEO of IDW Publishing. And I got to say, it was really awesome of him that he took time out of his day to sit down with Patrick and me. So it was really cool. I know he's a busy guy, so that was really nice of him. The conference room we were in, I guess the walls had, I wouldn't guess, they did have these like poster size copies of the some of the titles they publish. And on some of the shelves and other surfaces, they had the books on display too. I like to think it was done for us, but and even though I know better, a boy can dream. So I thought that was really cool to see all of those. All right, so this is a really fun conversation. I think you all will agree. I will hear you all on the flip side. Ted Adams. All right, so we are sitting down today. Let me get a little closer. We're sitting down today with Ted Adams, CEO of IDW. How are you doing, Ted?
I'm doing great. How about you?
Doing pretty well, pretty well. And also with Patrick. How are you doing, Patrick?
Hi, how's it going?
Patrick and I are actually sharing a mic because I don't have three. So I'll need to work on that. All right, so Ted, can you give us a little background? Growing up, have you always been into art, or did you kind of discover it at a certain point? point, and how did you discover
it? Yeah, well, maybe I wouldn't say art. I've always been into reading, so okay. I've been a voracious reader my entire life, really. From my earliest memories, I've been reading. My mom read to me when I was, you know, a baby, so right. basically my right. whole life, reading has been a big part of who I am. And so, you know, not just comic books, but everything. So, and I read, you know, nonfiction, fiction, comics, of course, magazines. I just, when I have free time, that's what I'm doing. I'm reading to this day. And, okay. you know, I've been that way my whole life. So I tell this story about when I used to make my family crazy because we'd go on summer vacations and we'd go to the Grand Canyon and I'd be the kid sitting in the car who'd want to read Rolling Stone magazine and not be going and looking at the Grand Canyon.
Not building a campfire.
I was never that kid. So, I've been a reader my whole life, and certainly a big part of what I read, you know, in my younger days was comic books, and certainly grew to love that art form as well. And one of the things that I always really liked was trying to, and I like this still today, is if I find something I'm interested in, to try and teach myself about that through books, you know, and, you know, I'm old. So if you look back when I was a kid and I was trying to learn about comic strips or comic books, you know, there of course was no computers, no internet back then. So the only way to do that was to look in the library at research around that. And I can still tell you the library, the Dewey Decimal numbers for the comic section is 741. Cause when we would travel, I'd ask my family to take me to libraries wherever we were so I could go to that section and see whatever reference books they had that I hadn't already read. So, and I was really into learning as much as I could about comics. So.
I'll have to put a wiki page for the Dewey Decimal System. I'm not sure anybody knows what that is anymore.
See, I told you I'm only 45 too. I want to put that out there.
So no,
that's old in today's terms.
I brought it up. I brought it up recently to a coworker, and he was like, "I don't know what." And I was right. like, "Never mind."
Well, it's funny because we just in San Diego just had a new library downtown that you guys know mm-hmm. is, you know, beautiful library. If you haven't been there, you should. But I was down there. They gave us a tour, kind of a before opening tour for a couple of us, and I did the same thing that I did when I was seven. I went right to 741. I was like, all right, we're section 741. And I know I impressed them that I knew that, I remember that code.
That's funny. That's funny. So, did you get into drawing?
You know, I did. It was funny. I was thinking about that. When I was young, I've got an 11-year-old now. And so, you know, I've been thinking a lot about it, and he has no interest. It's funny because he has no interest in reading, really. He's a San Diego kid. So he's all about outdoor activity, skateboarding and surfing and basketball and those kinds of things. So, it's funny how you don't necessarily pass along your passions to your kids, right? So, but I was thinking about his age, and I do remember I really did want to be an artist, and my mom, showed me that a bunch of things that I had drawn when I was around my son's age that he is now. And certainly I was drawing comic books and I, you know, was really interested in that side of it. But I don't know why, but I sort of fell out of doing that. I probably did it when I was like maybe 10 to 12. I was doing a lot of drawing and then just stopped and never picked it up again.
That's weird. I know a lot of people who kind of hit a point where they're just like, they stop mm-hmm. and then they come back to it. When you came back to it, did you find that you had sort of more passionate into
Well, I never came back to the art, you know, to the actual drawing side of it at all. So for me, it was, you know, when I was doing things creatively in comic books, it was more on the writing side. But my emphasis has always been on the business side, the publishing side of comics, marketing, PR, things like that.
Okay. And is that kind of what you wanted to get into?
Yeah, I mean, I knew I wanted to be not necessarily a comic publisher. I knew I wanted to work in publishing from a really young age because, again, I just loved reading. I loved books. And so, you know, as I was preparing in my head for my career, I focused on the business side. So my undergraduate degree and graduate degrees are both in business. And so, you know, I sort of prepared myself to be able to run a business. I also knew that I always wanted to own my own business and run my own business. So I didn't necessarily know I was going to run a comic book business. I didn't necessarily see myself as a comic book publisher. But I got that education. And then I also, the best publishing jobs that I could find, because I, even though I wanted to work in publishing, I didn't want to live in New York because I just not ever been a big fan of New York City. So, so I took my first job out of college was for a comic book publisher, Eclipse Books, which was a great comic book publisher and really influential to how I run IDW today. But I took that job right out of college. It was a marketing position and really gave me the chance. It was a small business, really got me the chance to see how a small business is run and specifically how a small comic book business is run. And then I transitioned from that job to Dark Horse Comics, which at the time was bigger than Eclipse. And so, still in the marketing space, but for a much bigger company, had the chance to work there for a couple of years. And then I worked for Jim Lee at Wildstorm Productions. Right. And I worked there for quite some time and, ran a couple of divisions for Jim. And then I went from there to work for Todd McFarlane. So, wow. So I got that experience working up in, and I was actually in LA. So I got the experience of working on, I ran Todd's comic book business, but I also learned about the entertainment business because we were working on the Spawn TV show and we were doing some music videos for Korn and Pearl Jam. So I worked with a really smart guy named Terry Fitzgerald when I was working for Todd. And then from there is when we started IDW. So if you look at my, you know, I kind of tell people I've my education and experience, I've been very prepared to become a comic book publisher, even though that wasn't necessarily what I set out to do.
What was your biggest challenge getting into the comic publishing side?
Well, the biggest challenge at the time when we started IDW was it we when we started the business, we didn't actually want to publish comics. We were a creative service business, which means that we were doing art and graphic design for entertainment companies. And so when we first started publishing comics, we were frankly, the four of us that started the business, a little burnt out on comics because we had all come from various positions in the comic world. So I think more than anything, it was just that, oh, wait, we actually do like doing this. It was sort of refining, you know, finding that passion again for comic books.
And comics at that point, because we were talking like mid to late 90s, right?
Yeah, when we started IDW, it was 1999. When we published our first comic, which was 30 Days a Night, that was 2001.
Right. So, and that was a tough, if I remember correctly, that was a really tough time.
It was a tough market back then.
Yeah, yeah, because the whole, the Marvel market and everything just kind of fell through in the mid to, and Image wasn't doing as hot as they were.
No,
doing. They
definitely, the sort of crash had come to the comics market, no question.
So it makes sense that you weren't. You know, how did that slowly start to happen? And was it a natural progression?
Yeah, it happened slowly. I mean, you know, this is over a long period of time. You know, if we started in 2001 and it's 2014, we've been publishing comics for 13 years. And so, our success didn't happen quickly. With that said, though, we had success with 30 Days of Night, not as a comic book, but as a graphic novel. And what happened was, is when we published 30 Days of Night, I was really, really proud of that comic book. I thought it was a great book. And and what I was trying to do is, since we were a brand new company, I was trying to fool the world into thinking that we were bigger than we were. So we had a lot of creative service clients back then. We had, I forget who they were specifically, but places like Electronic Arts and Sony Online and a bunch of different people. And so I told all of them, hey, I'm publishing a comic book. I'll put free ads for you in my comic book, right? And so basically I tried to make the comic book look like it was like bigger than it was, because I had ads for like all these things like EverQuest and all these things that were a big deal at the time. With that said, the comic sold terrible. It sold, you know, I forget number one sold, but maybe sold,
days.
You know,
yeah,
it's like,
yeah.
It sold like 3,000 copies or 4,000 copies. But I knew a lot of people in the comic business because I'd worked in it for more than a decade. You know, like I said, I worked for all these different publishers. And so I just called in every favor I had. I sent it to every retailer I knew. I sent it to all the press I knew. I knew people at Diamond. And so I just used through, you know, basically my own force of will, I brought an audience to that book because I liked it so much. It wouldn't have worked if it wasn't good material. So that was key. It had to be a good book, because you can't, you know, no matter what, I could call in every favor in the world, but if the book was lousy, you couldn't get people to read it or care about it. But the big thing for us was Wizard Magazine got behind 30 Days of Night in a big way, and they ran a bunch of articles. And this is back in the days when Wizard Magazine was really the force for news in the world of comics.
Thing,
it really,
really
was it.
Yeah.
There was no internet back then. Or if there was, it wasn't. The internet didn't matter.
It was
right?
too so, decentralized,
right,
at,
right.
if I recall.
Exactly. Yeah. And so Wizard was a tastemaker back then in a way that really nobody is today. And so they picked it, you know, they ran articles on it. They picked it as the number one hot book, meaning that it was a collectible book, so that they brought all this aftermarket value to the book. Anyhow, it's a long story, but all that then led to when the graphic novel version came out, the trade paperback came out. It was the number one selling trade paperback for the month. Mm-hmm. Outsold everything else in the market. And I can't tell you how insane that is.
Yeah,
so,
yeah,
I mean,
yeah.
you know,
That's
imagine,
crazy.
Imagine today there's a complete no-name company that comes out and they have the number one book
right.
in the market. Well, that's what we did. And so,
yeah,
you know,
no,
it was
really
just
cool.
unheard of. And so that really put us on the map. And then around that same time, we were doing comic books based on the TV show CSI, and that book, did really well for us. And so CSI back in those days, that was back when broadcast TV had a much bigger audience than it does today. Mm-hmm. The TV market today is very splintered, and, you know, there's a million different channels and a million different ways to watch TV. Back then, it was still very much, you had your cable networks. Prime time, basically. And it really did mean something, right? You didn't have DVRs. You didn't, you know, you just weren't, you know, people could record things on their VCRs, but it just wasn't the way it is today.
I don't even have cable now. I just use like Netflix and Hulu on my Roku.
I keep talking about doing that because actually I just got the new, not to go to a tangent, but I hate Time Warner Cable and I got a new bill from them yesterday and they raised all the rates. Yep. And I'm just thinking like, I don't even know why I have cable. You're going to raise my rates across the board.
It was funny though. My parents, I bought them a Roku for Christmas. This is so tangential. Sorry. But like, I bought them a Roku for Christmas and I was like literally because they told me they were paying $160 for their internet phone.
Right.
I was like, why do you have a phone? You guys are paying for cell phones on top of having a landline. Right. I'm like, this doesn't make any sense. Yeah. And you have cable. And they were like, we're not ready for that kind of transition. The Roku's really cool.
Right.
Like they had really like they love the Roku. Right. My mom can watch Netflix. She's like, now we don't have to get the DVDs anymore. Right. I'm like,
it's sports for me. Once I figure out how to watch live sports without cable, then I will no longer have cable. So,
yeah, there's ways. But
sorry. So CSI, you know, that was also a big success for us. Right. And so, and if you look at IDW today, you know, we're a very diverse comic publisher. But on our comic publishing business, we do basically those two kinds of books. We do creator-owned books like 30 Days of Night, and we do licensed books like CSI. So on the core comic business, that's still what drives the company today. It's just that instead of back then we were doing two books a month, now we're doing 70 books a month.
Right.
And so it's just the size of scale that's changed. We've also added a bunch of new divisions, like things like our artist edition, which where we reproduce the art at actual size. Yeah. We have our Library of American Comics, where we take classic American comic strips and bring them back into print. All those different things, our prose books and art books.
I mean, that's beginning to start to be a bigger market because I was just talking to Dan Greenfield, who runs 13th Dimension. It's a blog that just started up last year.
Okay.
But they're doing a lot to recognize Mark Waid's written a couple things for them. And they're doing a lot to recognize like the influence of classic comic literature on modern comic making. Which I never grew up with. In fact, I felt like growing up in the 90s and reading the comics that came out in the 90s, there was almost this kind of repulsion towards. And I think it was kind of needed because, you know, with the Jim Lee style of comics, like just that influx of like, we need new, we need fresh, we need that look. And it really hadn't happened in that kind of massive stylistic way.
Right.
But we kind of forgot to go back. You know, I feel like, and one of the things I love about IDW has been those artist editions. Because
I think that, you know, that's part of what I see, you know, and I told you that when I grew up, I was learning as much as I could about the art of comics. And so, you know, I was back looking, like I said, I was essentially doing my own research when I was 10 years old, looking at, you know, in the library for these things. And most of that material just wasn't in print. You couldn't find it. Mm-hmm. And so I was really fascinated with comic strips. And back then, the best book for that was a book called The Smithsonian Book of Newspaper Comic Strips. It was a big, big oversized book that reprinted, you know, maybe 20 to 100 strips from a whole bunch of classic strips. So everything from Terry and the Pirates to Popeye to Flash Gordon by Alex Raymond, you know, all these different things. But you just couldn't, at that time, you couldn't read 10 years worth of Chester Gould's Dick Tracy, right?
Right,
but
right.
Today you can, and I publish them, you know, so it's, you know, looking back at that, thinking that, you know, here I was this 10-year-old who was desperate for the books that I publish today. And, you know, my hope to a certain extent is that the books that we publish, you know, we certainly make some money from them and that's great. But I think that that's what we can do for the art community. If you're looking at the history of comics, we have presented that in a way that allows you to go back and you can read all of Alex Raymond's Rip Kirby. You can read all of Chester Gould's Dick Tracy. You can go back and look at all of the Little Orphan Annie strips. And we're reproducing them in a way that can allow you to appreciate that art. And what you were saying about the craft of the art is that people are so in the now, they forget that if you look at those strips that were being produced in the 20s and the 30s and the 40s, these guys were extraordinary artists. There's a level of craft there that nobody is doing today. You go back and look at what Alex Raymond was doing on Flash Gordon and Rip Kirby. There's nobody doing art like that.
Right.
There's just nobody doing it. Milton Caniff, you know, all these guys, you know, what Chester Gould did. It's just not, there's just that level of craft isn't there. And the other thing that's different, if you look at the history of the comic strip in particular, those guys were rock stars back then.
Right.
These guys were legitimate celebrities. You know, they were the equivalent of our rock stars today.
Right.
Because everybody read comic books or comic strips in their daily paper.
Even more so than now, I would say.
Oh, way more. Yeah. I mean, yeah. So, you know, these guys were truly celebrities, and they were compensated like celebrities back then. You know, these guys were making giant salaries. So, anyhow, so if you're interested in the history of the comic strip and comic art, which then of course led to comic books, you can learn all of that through the Library of American Comics.
Right.
And, you know, and I'm not trying to make a pitch here for my books. You know, if people are interested in the art of comics, you know, go and check these out of your library. That's what I would have done.
The big notable one.
741, exactly.
741. Yeah. The one I think was most notable was, we had, at the studio, we had, the Daredevil Born Again, the David Mazzucchelli one. And the thing that was striking to me is I had the trade paperback that Marvel put out, and it was terrible. And I was reading it, and I'm like not understanding why there's so much hype around this book because of the reproduction of it, right? Like because of the way that they glossed the printing.
Right.
And then I looked in the back of – now on top of that, the inks from every page he did with like one number two brush.
Right.
So
right.
Like, I mean, as an artist, I'm just like, this is insanity. Like you're looking at David Mazzucchelli's like full page inks and you're just like, how did he do this? Like I don't even understand how he pulled this off. But then I was looking in the back of the book. And you guys had actually taken original pages, colored pages, because one of the people who don't get a lot of recognition within the industry, I feel like, are colorists.
Sure.
But especially in that, it was like, what, 80s, like late 80s?
Yeah, sorry, like the mid-80s maybe.
Mid-80s. And I was just kind of blown away by when you guys did the high-quality scans of the pages as they originally came out.
Right.
The colors actually work with the paper.
Right.
That they were being printed on. And so when it got translated to that high gloss, it really kind of lost what the artist intended it to look like.
Sure.
And that was kind of disappointing. I almost wanted them to like re-release it as it would have been released as a trade paperback in the 80s after I saw that, because I was like, I want to read this book as it was meant to be seen, not as like, oh, let's do a quick runoff because people want this book. You know?
Yeah, I mean, what you're talking about there are the artist editions, which are, you know, those focus on comic books and you know, it's the same idea as a Library of American Comics, where we're looking at the comic strips and doing big giant swaths of comic strips. So, you know, in some cases, decades of comic strips. We're publishing decades of Dick Tracy by Chester Gould. In the artist editions, what we're doing is showing it at actual size. So, and each artist edition is at a different size because it's reproduced at the size the artist drew it. So the Mazzucchelli book is at a different size than the Jeff Smith Bone book.
Yeah,
and
so,
because it's based off of whatever it was originally drawn at. We've done some books that artist edition books around EC Comics and the original Mad Comics, and those are giant. Those are truly giant books because they're reproduced at the size that the artist drew them at. And the whole goal there is what you're just referencing, which is that if you want to learn about the history of comics and you want to learn about how art is produced, these books allow you to see what these artists did. It allows you to see the brush strokes. You can see the whiteout. You can see the blue lines. You can actually see how that, you know, what that book or what that art looks like when it was on the artist drawing table. So,
which as an artist, like one of the things I think that was a bad side effect of being, maybe it still happens to young artists who are coming up now, as it did to me, of like not looking to the past, is you tend to gloss over that stuff only because you're like, it doesn't look good. It doesn't look as good as, you know, but that's a lot of the times the only thing that you only have access to as a young artist is what's cheap and at the comic book store right now, as opposed to, you know, remembering that there's a library you might be able to go to look at some of these more expensive books. But like, I think every artist should have at least one artist edition, like for their, if they're coming up to creating comic books, like if you can afford, you know, that, they're 150-ish.
Yeah, I mean, it depends sort of on the trim size of the book, but they're in the $100 to $125 range.
Yeah. But for me, like the amount of studying that you can do into the craft by looking at a book like that, because
we've been able to really publish the masters of the form, you know, the modern guys like Mazzucchelli and Jeff Smith and Sergio Aragonés, and then all the way back to Wally Wood and EC artists Joe Kubert. We've done Will Eisner. We've done Mark Schultz. I mean, these are all guys that would without any question all be considered masters of the form.
And these guys were guys paving the way to what right. comic books are now. Right. We can't really take that for granted because they were actually experimenting in ways we might not even think to do because of the status quo of how things are currently.
And we've got a couple. We're actually doing our first comic strip artist edition. We're doing Charles Schulz's Peanuts artist edition, and that'll come out in a couple of months so people will be able to see his work. We're doing Jack Kirby, who of course is the the king of comics, and so you'll be able to
that'll
see his
awesome.
Work. So and we're doing Jim Steranko, who is he's Jim Steranko, right? So
yeah.
Enough said.
Do you think? I guess one of my questions, just hearing the history, because in your involvement with the Image guys and like that kind of come up. What do you think? I'm going to tell you a quick story. I literally decided not to go to the Joe Cooper Center for the college because that was the only like art school that you could do to study comics. But I went and visited there twice. I did two interviews with them and I got into the school and like I decided not to go because I grew up with the Image comics story and like the Mavericks and the industry and like the early, and I mean I was, this is like 2001, so like that's when I was going to school. But I decided to go to graphic design school because there was like tech being taught at a higher level at the design school than there was going to be going to do traditional comic book making.
Right.
I realize now I could have done either or. It would have been fine. I'm where I am. It doesn't really matter. But do you think being around that kind of like industry outside of the big two was really instrumental in what you've been doing with IDW for the last?
Maybe. I mean, yeah, I hadn't really thought of it in that way. I suppose it's more, for me, it's more, I worked for a lot of entrepreneurs. And so for me, it was more learning from those entrepreneurs and having them as mentors really helped me build the business. You know, what you were saying about the Kubert School made me start thinking about, Jim and Todd specifically. And I think that what makes Jim and Todd successful as artists is what makes everybody successful, successful people, no matter what field they're in. And that is that those guys have a crazy work ethic. Mm-hmm. And, I've become, as I've gotten older, very much a believer in the people who are successful are the people who work the hardest at it.
Yeah.
You know, there's almost no luck that goes into success, And so, I don't know that I've ever met anybody that works harder than Jim Lee, right? And the guy has everything. You know, he's a hugely successful guy, but he's an unbelievably hardworking guy. You know, when I worked for him, he was up all night drawing and then back in the office the next day, helping to run his business. And so, and McFarlane is certainly the same way. So, but with that said, I think that a place like the Kubert School, if you can go and interact with other artists and learn from them and learn from their influences and have instructors that are going to show you things, that here's the way to do this and here's a way not to do that. You know, there's nothing but good that can come from that.
Right.
But ultimately, what's going to make you a successful artist is you having your butt in your chair and at the drawing table and drawing 10 hours
it's
a day.
Ethic.
It's work. It's hard work. It's not ever going to come easy. And, look at the early work from Jim and Todd. You know, if you want to look at them specifically, their early stuff is not good. They'd be the first to tell you that.
Yeah.
You know, they had to draw
their art very much grew up in the spotlight of what they were doing because, it was so interesting how this is another tangent, but it was so interesting how they came up because I really think it was style. Their style was so bold and different that they were given a lot of measure to do experiment in the spotlight than you might see currently in the business.
It's hard to say. I don't know. I mean, I think that those guys also were, they were so successful at the time and, people forget again, it's like, hindsight is, the Image was successful. And so therefore, these guys were geniuses, but what made them genius was their courage to do that.
Right.
They were leaving unbelievably high paying jobs at Marvel.
Right.
They had a lot to risk. They didn't have a little bit to risk. They were risking a lot because they were really well compensated when they were working at Marvel and they walked away from that to go start a new business. And of course it became successful, but nobody knew it was going to be successful. Right. But with the hindsight, we all look at it 2020 and be like, oh, well, everybody knew Image was going to be successful.
No,
Nobody knew that was going to be successful. And they didn't walk away from jobs that were, $10 an hour jobs. They walked away from jobs that were probably paying them millions of dollars each. And so, that courage, And that self-confidence to be able to do that, that's again sort of what separates them from the rest of the world. The work ethic, the self-confidence, the willingness to take that risk. And you see that in their art. So.
Yeah, I just read an interview with Mark Silvestri, I think like a year ago, and he was talking about how he would never have done it if he'd known. He's like 20 years into the game, it's longer than that. It's
right.
Like almost 25 years or something.
Sure.
And he was just like, I would never have made that move. Like everything I know about publishing, like, it was just not. Right. It was because it sounds like I don't know what the relations were. I think it took a long time for them to repair some of the bridges, but I don't know. That's a whole other story. But it's interesting. I'm really interested in the fact that you kind of came up through that. Because I the way that I see IDW, I don't see how you couldn't be influenced by that.
Yeah, well, I think it was that risk-taking, you know, more than anything that probably influenced me and you know, trying to do things differently. And so that's what we've tried to do.
Go ahead. You got into it with a couple different people, right? It wasn't just you that started
There were four of us that started the business. One of those four is still with IDW as well.
Did they have the same... did they have the same background? I mean, did they come from that?
We actually all came from working at Wildstorm at different times. So that's how we knew each other. The four of us that started at IDW all came from Wildstorm. We didn't all necessarily work at Wildstorm at the exact same times, but that was sort of the thing that brought us together. They weren't necessarily, two of the guys weren't necessarily comic book guys, but Alex Garner was one of the partners. Alex is a terrific artist who's used to be Jeff Campbell's inker on Danger Girl and Gen 13, and now does really beautiful covers for DC Comics. So he's definitely a comics guy. Robbie Robbins, who's still my business partner today, he's not a comics guy. He didn't grow up reading comics. And then Chris Aprisco, who was the fourth partner. I think was kind of interested in comics, but not probably not as nutty about it as I was.
I was thinking about IDW. How do you see? So, I feel like IDW has like a three-pronged kind of like output. You have like your licensed titles, and you're describing 30 Days a Night versus CSI.
Right.
And then I'm also always thinking about, because I don't remember interacting much with IDW for like the last 5 years, but I also grew up in a small town in the woods in New Hampshire.
Well, we were a much smaller presence 5 years ago, too.
Right. How do you see that? I mean, I guess what's the vision?
It's funny because everybody asks me this question because I make people crazy because people want to put you in a box. It's really funny. It's like, you know, it's like that Dirty Dancing thing, right? But I'm not going to be put in a box. And so,
nobody's so,
in the corner. That's right. But it's true. It's like everybody wants to be like, well, what's IDW? And it's like, well, we're a publisher. Nobody asks Random House, you know, what kind of publisher are you? Well, they're a publisher. And I feel like I have the same response. I'm a publisher.
An
and so it's like,
response, though,
yeah. And like, so because, but it's not you. It's everybody. Everybody wants to put you in a box. And I think the reason for that is because it's just, we want to classify things in our head. And the truth is that if you love Transformers, then you put us in that box.
Right.
Awesome. You love Lock and Key? Put us in that box. You only buy our artist editions? Great. There's a box for you over there, right?
Yeah,
you like the comic strips? There's Library of American Comics. You can go have that box. And so, you know, so we're different things to different people. As far as what my vision for the company is that to be a publisher, not to be a licensed comic publisher or a creator-owned publisher or a comic strip publisher, to be a publisher.
Yeah.
And so to the extent where we've dabbled in picture books, we've done a whole line of children's picture books. We've done prose books. We do art books. We've done a book from a couple of good friends of mine around an art gallery called Device, which is primarily a gallery devoted to sculptures. And so we've done art books around that.
Right.
So, you know, so we're a publisher. And if somebody brings me a book that I love, you know, we're best at publishing comic type material, but even that doesn't stop us. I'll do the sculpture, you know, the gallery book for a sculpture gallery. You know, we do prose books. We do all kinds of things.
Are you mostly doing interviews with comic industry people? Is that what you?
Yeah.
Is the people? I would imagine the people who want to put you in the box are mostly the comic bloggers.
Well, pretty much everybody wants to put me in a box. Like, it's funny. Everybody wants us just to do one thing. It's very interesting. So,
well,
it's just something about.
No,
I think it's just something about human.
I just think it's something about human nature
that you want to classify things in your head, and I just don't let people do that. And it makes them crazy.
Well, yeah. I mean, and that was kind of my interaction with it. I don't think I experienced you holistically as a publisher. I think the first times I probably interacted with IDW was probably in a comic book store. So, like, obviously, I'm like thinking like, and it does make me think about Marvel or DC, where their comic branches, if you would say, are that's all they do is they do superhero comics. Right. They're like, we are a superhero. I mean, Icon maybe does stuff outside.
Yeah, and I think that there was a time when, you know, and those guys do great superheroes. So this is not me disparaging Marvel or DC, because I think, you know, the superhero comics they're both doing are terrific. But there was a time when DC had a bigger, you know, with Vertigo and even pre-Vertigo, those books were not superhero books. And really those were a lot of the books that kept me interested in comics. And so, you know, I think that over time they, you know, both Marvel and DC have become a little more superhero centric, but you know, DC still has great books on Vertigo. I mean, they're, you know, Unwritten is a terrific book. And so.
So my question, now I can't remember the story though. We were talking about it on another podcast, but the one in, New York that just dropped superhero comics mm-hmm. completely. What's interesting is they can drop superhero comics and still keep a lot of titles.
Sure. Well, I just saw online on Bleeding Cool or someplace that the top 20 graphic novels in February, as measured by Bookspan, there was not a single Marvel or DC book on that list.
Wow. So. Wow. Yeah, no, I mean, it's just an interesting thing. The landscape seems to be changing a lot from where, you know, Wizard Magazine was king, and that was what you got in your supermarket, and that's what I read growing up, and that's not even available. I don't even know where you get a print, like, news rag about comic books.
Well, Bleeding Cool has their magazine. I don't know if they sell it at newsstand, but they do.
They're not everywhere. So. I don't think
certainly doesn't have the impact that Wizard had.
Right.
Although Bleeding Cool online, you know, arguably does.
I guess because you're CEO of IDW and you have to know this stuff, like, how do you see the landscape of comics changing right now?
Well, it's really diverse. That's what I love about comics right now, is that it's, you know, one of our best selling books is My Little Pony, right? And that, you know, and that's being sold to little girls.
No,
you know,
I've had a couple students who loved
it. Yeah, no, it's, you know, those books, that book has expanded, the audience for comics, there's no question. And, you know, I've been going into lots of comic stores. I've been traveling and stopping in comic stores, places that I've never been, people who don't know me, and just checking out the store before I go and introduce myself. And almost to a store, they have a nice little My Little Pony section, including My Little Pony at the cash register. And when I go introduce myself, they all tell me the same thing, which is, wow, you have brought in so many kids into this store. Right. And so that's a lot of these stores now have sections devoted to kids that didn't have that before. And certainly we've tried to take advantage of that by increasing the amount of kids comics that we do, so they have more things to sell to kids. But, you know, if you look at the readers of comics today, it is so crazy diverse. It's unbelievable. When I was reading comics as a young teenager, it was comic stores. That's where you bought comics. Right. And right. So, and you know, it was mostly guys, and you know, that's just what it was. But today the audience for comics is completely diverse, to the point where what happens is that people who are regular comic readers that only go to comic stores, that's all they think about are those comic stores. They don't understand that comics are sold at Scholastic book fairs, that, you know, that comics are the Diary of Wimpy Kid is essentially a comic book, you know? And yeah, so, yeah. You know, so we're selling comics in a way into people
Captain
that
Underpants.
They're so Captain Underpants, all this. I mean, it's just, no, really. I mean, if you think about it, it's just like, yes, the comic stores are still primarily Marvel and DC stores, but we're all fortunate that comics are sold in lots of different places these days. And so our reach of this medium is much more significant than it ever was before.
It's almost a return back to what it was during the 50s, where you had, or the early 50s anyway, where you had like romance books, and Western books, and that, because I was reading 10 Cent Plague, and they were talking about the landscape of comics being so different, because we have to remember that comic books were special effects entertainment. You didn't have television with color on it, you know, and even if you had a television, it was like this big, and with a comic, you had these like...
And now we all have TVs that are that big again, right, because we watch TV on our phones.
It's always a return, right? No, I guess that's an interesting response. That's cool. I like that.
I had a question. I was looking over here at the Lock and Key, and I know who Joe Hill is. I know where he came from, but I was actually surprised at first when I saw his name on a graphic novel.
Mm-hmm.
Have you ever been surprised by that an artist or a writer came to you, or you discovered?
Well, yeah, and you know, just to give you the backstory on Joe, when we got into business with Joe, he had not published any books in the U.S. At the time, he had only published a lot of short stories that had a lot of critical acclaim.
Right.
And I assume you're referencing part of the reason you know Joe is because of his dad.
Right.
When we got into business with him, you know, we didn't know that relationship, when we started publishing Lock and Key. Right. Nobody really in the U.S. knew much about Joe, because he was a short story writer. It had a collection published in the U.K., which is actually where I discovered his work and fell in love with it, which is what led me to just send him an email. Luckily, he was a fan of 30 Days a Night. So we got into business on Lock and Key. we didn't know his family relationship. He was not a published author, certainly wasn't a novelist in the U.S. yet. And right around the time that Lock and Key came out, the story about his dad broke at the same time that his first novel came out. And, you know, and he has since gone on to be the Joe Hill that you know, is the, you know, New York Times bestselling author, you know, wildly critically acclaimed author, you know, just, you know, who he is today. So was I surprised who Joe Hill became during the course of our relationship? Not really, because he was a great writer. You know, the fact that his dad is Stephen King has nothing to do with the fact that he's a great writer. And so, so people, because of his success, because of the success he's had with Lock and Key and the success he's had as a novelist, people want to immediately put that relationship between him and his dad, but that's all because he's, it again goes back to like what I was saying with 30 Days a Night. I couldn't have convinced people to like 30 Days a Night if it hadn't been good. And it's the same with Joe. You know, if he wasn't a great writer, people wouldn't be interested.
The only thing I was going to say was with Lock and Key, I didn't even know the relationship. I think you guys gave us a couple copies to give away at one of our, at the opening of the studio. And I read it. One of the things I was blown away from in that book was just that it was an approach to the horror comic that really hadn't, there's no mainstream horror comics like for the last 10 years that weren't like vampires or zombies.
Right.
And this was a book where I was like, this is a definitely unique approach.
Well, it's a character driven book. It's the horror. It's certainly, there's certainly, really graphic horror in it, but it's a character driven book. But also part of what works with Lock and Key is the relationship with Joe and Gabe Rodriguez, the artist. You know, those two work hand in hand in a way that you don't often see in comics. And what you also don't often see in comics is a story that has a very specific beginning, middle, and end. And that entire story was done essentially by three people, by Joe, Gabe, and the colorist Jay Photos. And so, and they were there every page. Every single page of that book is by the same creative team. So, you don't see a whole lot of that in comics. That doesn't happen often. And I particularly think that I was telling somebody this the other day that one of the things that's nice about Lock and Key, and it's selling like mad for us right now. It's been the number one New York Times bestseller for the last 3 weeks, which I love because I'm very proud of having helped bring Lock and Key into the world. But part of the reason that works is that Joe and Gabe, they stuck the landing, right? So people who read that book from issue one and then read all the way to the end, it ends in a really satisfying way. And a lot of times, particularly in genre fiction, it's easy to tell these big stories, but it's hard to stick the landing. And, you know, I think of things like Lost or things that, you know, where I was really passionately involved in it. I just wasn't crazy about the way, the way it ended. And so, so I feel like, Breaking Bad ended in a really satisfying way to me as a viewer. And I feel like Lock and Key, if you're a reader, it ended, it ended in a satisfying way.
So. Lock and Key. I think I passed the second volume and I just hadn't picked it up because I was waiting for it to end because the problem that I had with Why the Last Man, I love Why the Last Man. It's like one of the top comics.
Sure. It's a great book. Brian Vaughn is a genius. I mean, he's in Saga.
Oh yeah. But I couldn't stand it when it was coming out issue to issue. I was like going crazy trying to read that. And I could tell right from the beginning of Lock and Key. I was like, I gotta wait for this to come out because I gotta read the whole thing at the same time. So it's all finished now.
It's done. Yeah. All six. Awesome. All six.
Are you gonna do like a big book at some point?
I don't know. You know, we've got the six. There's six volumes, and we're pretty happy with those. They're available both in hardcover and trade paperback. Joe's not crazy about the big giant format.
Omnibus. And
frankly, the books are selling extremely well in the way we're selling them.
Right,
so I'm not
now.
Sure that I necessarily want
to
mess
That's
with
like
that.
That's like a conversation maybe. Several years from
maybe,
now,
yeah.
if it comes
yeah,
up.
We'll
yeah,
see.
Yeah, yeah,
so, but,
No, that's interesting.
What are some of the, I guess we can kind of, so we're getting towards the end here. What are the, what are some of the short-term goals that you guys have coming up that you can let us in on?
Well, there's a couple, if we look at the publishing business, we've got a bunch of things that we're excited about, but there's four creator-owned books that we're launching over the next 4 months that I'm particularly proud of. The first one is V-Wars, which is by Jonathan Mayberry and Alan Robinson. And this spins out of a prose anthology that Mayberry edited for us. And that launches on Free Comic Book Day. It's one of our Free Comic Book Day offerings. I'm pretty excited about that book. Then the next month we have Winter World by Chuck Dixon and Butch Geis. And Winter World was a book that Chuck originally did with Jorge Zaffino, back in the 80s. We republished it as a graphic novel. It's a really beautiful book. And so Chuck is relaunching that with us, like as I said, with Butch Geis. Really beautiful art and just fun storytelling. Really good adventure just in the way that Chuck Dixon does so well. Then the next month we have Ragnarok by Walt Simonson. And this is Walt's take on Norse gods. Yeah. So I keep telling people, I feel like enough said on that. You know, the marketing pitch is done on that once I say
that. He's got some history with those Norse gods. So that's a guy to read for that.
Yeah, we're excited about that one. And then we've also got Little Nemo in Slumberland, which, of course, was a classic comic strip by Winsor McCay. And we're doing a new version of that by Eric Schanauer and Gabe Rodriguez, the artist of Lock and Key.
That's right. So, and Eric's going to be on the MOOC.
Absolutely.
Well, he's another local San Diegan.
Yeah.
One of the coolest artists.
Very nice guy. Eric is about as nice as he gets. So we got those. And then the other thing I'm proud of that we're launching from a creator standpoint is, if you look back to the early days of IDW, there were a handful of artists that were with us. Ash Wood, Ben Temple Smith, certainly Gabe Rodriguez, and Steve Niles. And so Gabe's doing Little Nemo with us. Gabe's really, for all intents and purposes, only ever worked for IDW. He's gone from one IDW project to the next. And really proud of that. So we're doing a book with Steve Niles in the fall called October Faction with an artist, Damian Worm. So I'm really happy about that. Ben Temple Smith is doing a comic with us called The Squitter, which I'm excited about. And then Ashwood has a new series he's doing with TP Louise called The Beautiful War. So we also have all those books going on. And then on the bigger business side, we're have launched IDW Games. And our first game comes out this June based off of our comic book that we do called Kill Shakespeare. And so we're launching that in June. And then on the really big side, we launched IDW Entertainment last year, so that we're actually developing our own TV projects. And we're no longer optioning projects to Hollywood. We're actually going out and commissioning pilot scripts and financing the shows ourselves.
Are you excited about that?
I am excited. You know, it's a big venture. It's a little scary because it's –
It sounds
really
scary.
It's
a lot more moving parts than a comic.
It definitely keeps me busy. But it's really the next step forward for IDW, and certainly excited about
that. Are you shooting in L.A.? Or are you going to be shooting
It'll be – part of what we're doing is taking advantage of tax subsidies that are available. So it'll be largely dependent on where those tax subsidies are.
Oh, okay. Okay. Cool. Yeah. Cool. Just going back a minute, I remember what I was going to say. I lost it, but I was reading you did a response to
Eric Stevenson.
But I was reading, because your interview was last on a couple. It was like there was another guy that they talked to, and then you. And then I was reading yours, and one of the things I just wanted to let you know that I actually took away from it, because you referenced the My Little Pony thing and talking about My Little Pony, and I was thinking to myself, I was like, what was the first comic book I actually went out and bought and read? And I was 8, and I got the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles like comic book, and that was before I ever got a Superman comic, or before I even I think I might have had access to Archie, because that was everywhere.
Sure, right. Everybody always had Archie, right?
So. I had Spy versus Spy, because I had an old one in the drawer, but I do remember that it was a licensed property though that really got me. And I remember I read it and I was like, oh, I like this better than the cartoon, because I can actually reread this at my own pace and I can move to the middle of it and I don't have to wait for it to air on TV. I was 8 years old but I just wanted to say that that argument, or even that presentation of that, it just in my head, it jolted me back to that time.
Right.
And I really do relate to these kids who are coming in and reading My Little Pony.
Sure.
And that's a really important.
What we
those
want.
Aren't fake right. comics. Like those are comics, right. and right. I think it is not a nice thing to say that.
Right.
About
well, it's not just it's not just. And first of all, it's you know, if you read the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles comic that we published today, it's a great comic.
Right.
It's written by Tom Waltz and Kevin Eastman. It's got terrific art. It's a good comic.
It
was on many best of the year lists last year. It's a really good comic book. Who cares if it's a licensed comic book? It's a good comic book. So, and you know what Eric said is not just insulting to my company. It's really insulting to the people that work on those books. I employ a lot of artists that work on those books. You're talking on any given month, probably 30 or 40 different artists that are working on licensed books, maybe more.
Right.
And so it's insulting to those people. It's insulting to the editors that work on them. And it's insulting to the retailers who sell them. And it's at most insulting to the people who read them.
Yeah,
we're talking hundreds
kids,
of thousands of people.
Yeah.
In the case of My Little Pony, My Little Pony number one in all versions has probably sold, 700,000-800,000 copies. It has sold a giant number of copies, right?
Which no one is doing.
Right.
That much,
right. Right. Yeah, and so we're introducing comics to all those people. Don't insult those people. It's ridiculous. Listen, I like what Image publishes. I told you I like Sega,
right.
but But Image Comics isn't the end all and be all to the diversity of comics. And so, you know, I think, you know, people keep, and it puts me in this position where Eric went out and made these comments. And so, you know, I'm forced to respond to it because people like you asked me about it. You know, I would never go out and be dismissive of somebody else's product in that way. It was just an insulting thing to do. And it's hard for me to fathom why he did it.
No. Yeah.
It seems like it's almost contradictory to what art is anyway.
Right.
I mean, the idea of art is, it's for everybody.
Exactly.
You know, and when you try to limit it, well, you've limited art itself.
Right.
So
well, that's why I was joking when the first person responded to me, I was listening to some of the books we did, and I made the joke. It's like, do you consider those to be real comics, Eric, since you're the arbiter of what's a real comic and what's a good comic? You know, like, how about we live in a world where we have the freedom that I can choose what I like and you can choose what you like and that little five-year-old can choose what she likes, right?
And, so. And I mean, honestly, the fact that you guys have that three-prong, at least from my standpoint, where you're doing like the
put me back
edition.
In that box, aren't you?
Yeah. All right. I'm not doing that. The box. But from what I've consumed, so my limited knowledge of the 70 titles you put out. But from what I've consumed though, like especially the artist editions in the classic comics that you're reprinting. One of the only other people in the industry who are doing that is like I feel like. Fantagraphics and other small publishers.
Well, Fantagraphics does, you know, they're the granddaddy of all this stuff. I mean, there's no publisher I love more than Fantagraphics.
Right,
those guys
but they're
are
like
amazing,
and they're not even. I don't want to say they're not as big a publisher, but I don't feel like they're as big a publisher.
Well,
like,
it just depends on how you measure. I mean, you know, certainly we have bigger market share in the comic stores, but you know, they publish peanuts, and so you know, I'm sure they've sold a lot of those.
Right,
books,
right. But so if you're looking at like who are the artistic, forefront, I mean, I would say you guys are doing more to preserving the history of comic books and presenting that as in a consumable medium, but like than many of the other publishers are. Like, I just don't see it coming out. Mm. I don't see Marvel I mean, I'm not trying to slam them.
Right.
I'm just saying that, like, I respect that as an artist. And I mean, I loved Spawn and Spider-Man and all of the big franchises when I was growing up. But now that I'm actually making comics, I'm touring to shows, and I'm struggling hard to get my work shown.
Right.
It's really important that these books get published, only because how else am I supposed to learn this stuff? I mean, if we're only relying on YouTube like, to teach us, we're going to come up a little bit short, you know, just a little bit short. And that curating you guys put so much effort into curating the work, and that's
yeah. And just to be fair, it's, you know, the Library of American Comics is Dean Mullaney and Lorraine Turner and Bruce Canwell, and the, you know, those are the folks that are actually doing those books. So I'm just fortunate to publish them, but they're the ones who are,
so
are doing the.
I got
the
a
hard
question
there,
for
so.
You. Because you sound like you know a lot about this stuff. If you were starting out as an artist right now, what books should we read?
Wow, that's a good question.
Because we'll post links to them.
Yeah, you know, I don't know. I think it's just so dependent on what you respond to, and I think that's what, you know, people find their own passions, and you know, I think that it's, you know, for me to just say, hey, these are the five books you should read is not the way to go.
Right,
I think my advice would be to go, you know, go to the library, go to the bookstore, go to the comic store, and just spend some time there browsing and see what you gravitate towards, and you know, and find your influences there, find what you like and where your passions lie and sort of learn from there. You know, I don't think that, I don't think there's, you know, me saying, hey, these are the five books that.
All right. Yeah. Maybe I phrased the question wrong. Maybe I mean, like, what's a recommendation for a book that
there's a book that we publish, and you know, this isn't me trying to sell IDW product, but there's a book that we publish that I think is an important book that frankly got a little overlooked last year, which is The Worlds of Sam Keith. And basically it's Sam's autobiography in the form of an art book. And I've never read a book where an artist has had the courage to go out and present his life story in a way that Sam does in that book. And it's basically the story of what brought him to become an artist. It's his artistic influences. It's how he draws. It's really looking into the mind of an artist in a way that I've never seen before. And so I think and I also think that part of what Sam talks about is the fact that he felt like an outcast for a lot of his life because of the way he approached art and the way he approached the world. And I think that for people who are maybe find themselves in that feeling, those same sorts of feelings, that reading Sam's book could maybe give you, you know, maybe make you feel like, you know, that you're not alone out there.
Yeah,
so,
cool.
You know, I think it's it's a book. I'm not trying to sell you my book, but you know, if you find it at the library or, you know, it's a book that I think is, is a unique opportunity to look into the head of a really important artist.
Well, let us know, too. I mean, I would say for the site, what we're trying to do with Making Comics, and we are operating on no profit. It's going to be it's a complete charitable. Like, what we're trying to do is free up art education so that aspiring creators all over the world can actually have access to stuff that's been behind, you know, collegiate paywalls or just locked up in a first world country that, you know, not everybody has access to. So part of the challenge, I was really blown away by there's programs like Khan Academy, but it teaches math, and there's other big productions in the science, technology, engineering, and math world that are pushing education out Wikipedia style to everybody in the world, and quality education. And I look at the comic book industry and I'm like, we're not doing that.
No, and I think you're right. And especially if you look at where, you know, in public schools, a lot of times the arts are where they get cut first. And so, you know,
Comic books is even a smaller portion.
Not that many art, you know, but with that said, I think that, you know, good art teachers and good English teachers and just good teachers in general, if a kid has a passion that leads them to comic books that then brings them to art or brings them to reading, a good teacher is not going to be dismissive of that. They're going to say, hey, you know, this is great. You're learning about art this way. You're learning how to read this way. Who cares if it's a comic book? Hopefully, we're past that stigma a little bit. But you know,
we're getting there. It's an antiquated system that moves slower than any other one in the entire world. So,
but I do think that, you know, in particular, since the art departments are often the ones to get the axe first when money is cut, that having those things available, and certainly if we can be helpful in that way,
just hearing your entire history and how well read you are with the stuff, and it's reflected in the work that you guys are actually putting out, because I know that on some level that's a vision statement of saying, like, we don't know if this book's going to do well, but it's really important to publish. That's important. That's an important statement to make. So if you think of things and want to just throw it our way so that we can recommend it to our readers, please feel free to do so. Because, I mean, I think that knowledge needs to be out there, that recognition, and also just, like, the research. I mean, a lot of people, we're not trying to create a prescriptive way of making comics, because actually that's antithetical to making a good comic. But that doesn't mean education can't happen, right? Like, so we got to find that middle ground, and we'd love your help in any way. In that. So,
yeah, I guess that sums it up.
I'm good.
All right, Ted, thank you for sitting down with us today.
Sure, absolutely.
All right. First of all, I really need to get Patrick to use his microphone voice. I'm not sure why he's so afraid of him. I saw an interview with him last year sometime, and he was also, you know, this far away. So anyway, I'll have to work on that. All right. So that was a pretty fun interview. I definitely appreciate Ted's willingness, I guess the IDW's willingness and desire to publish work from, you know, anything from graphic novels to, I don't know, coffee table books, it seemed like. I think, you know, when people ask me what kind of music I listen to, I typically say, you know, what makes my ears feel good. And this just seemed like one of those instances, you know, where, you know, if they see something that they really like, they're absolutely open to publishing it. And I think that's a pretty admirable thing. Speaking of publishing things, there is just one thing I wanted to say about a topic that came up towards the end, and I'm not going to go into it. But, you know, it's pretty much the row that Ted got into recently. But, you know, where and how comics and really just art in general is distributed, as well as really who it's distributed to, that's not the ultimate goal. And to think it is a bit remiss and, I think, off the mark, maybe missing the point. To me, I think the fact of the matter is it's simply just to make sure it's distributed to everyone, anyone who wants it, anybody that is open to consuming it, they should have the ability to consume it, and not have to really go looking for it. So, you know, seriously, people, let's anyway. All right, so Ted, thank you very much for taking the time again to sit down with us. That was a lot of fun, and I definitely appreciate the time. All right, mentioned in the intro, but again, if you are in Anaheim this weekend, starting today, basically the weekend this podcast is released, because I know some of you may be listening to this in the future. But if you are listening to this weekend, the weekend this is released, April 18th through the 20th, come check us out at WonderCon if you're in Anaheim. We have a Saturday panel at 4 p.m., Room 210A, Making Comics with the World. Got a lot of cool panelists that I mentioned in the intro. You know, Jason Brubaker, the creator of Cythra and Remind, Shelly Cuvion, Rachel Beck from Storyforge Productions, as well as the few of us from MakingComics.com, Patrick, Devin, Kevin, and myself. So you definitely want to come check that out. That's going to be a fun panel. We'll try to get the audio up. We'll do our best. All right, so next week's episode. This is the redrop of Jason Brubaker's original Making Comics podcast. This is the his episode number 2. So definitely make sure you are tuning into that. Those old podcasts are really awesome, and I'm really looking forward to getting them out to you every last Friday of the month. And next Friday happens to be the last Friday of April. 2014 is moving way too fast. But anyway, until next week, be good to people.